Good morning. All right. How about a little bit of excitement this morning? All right. We ate a big breakfast. Everybody's full. Don't plan on taking a nap. I'll do my best to try to keep you awake. At any rate, welcome to Severn Covenant Church. My name's Aaron. I work at Severn Covenant Church, so you'll find me here from 9 to 5 on any given day of the week. I'm also part of the teaching team here at Severn Covenant Church, so you'll see me periodically up here at the pulpit giving our teaching pastor, Ryan Cox, a breather whenever he needs it. Today happens to be his birthday. He's not here, so you're going to have to shoot him an email, give him a phone call, or find him and follow him on what we call Twitter. Now, there is another famous person in our midst that I can't go without mentioning, Ryan's brother, Jeff Cox. It is also his birthday today. Ha-ha! Don't want to downplay that at all. Before I get started, I just want to bring you up to speed. Yesterday, a group of about 20 of us gathered here for our new members class, had a great time, got to know those who showed up, and walked away both encouraged, enlightened, and looking forward to the next opportunity to get to know some of you a little bit better. So let's get right to it. This is week two in a series that we've called Jesus Is, where we as a church, we're taking a look at some of the statements that Jesus made about himself. We're looking at the way which in which Jesus actually defined himself by some of the things that he said. So to get started, I'd like to just say this. We live in an age of religious plurality or spiritual plurality. It's a time during which truth is something that is perceived by many as relative. And here's a thought for you. In this day and age, it doesn't really matter what you believe as long as you're sincere. Right? Maybe you've heard that, maybe you haven't. It's a time that causes a real dilemma for followers of Jesus, who, quite frankly, on a lot of occasions are classified as intolerant, bigotous, politically incorrect, and this comes as a direct result of shifting paradigms with regards to sexuality, marriage, politics, you name it. We're kind of on the outside of the camp in a lot of regards. And I'd like to suggest this, that the polarizing effect of Christianity is not so much a result of our positions on ethics or morality or marriage or sexuality, in as much as it's a direct reflection of the polarizing effect of the one who stands at the center of Christianity, namely Jesus. So all those other issues, while they're important, they're merely just secondary or tertiary issues when it comes to answering the question of why we're here and for whom are we here. And we're going to talk a little bit about the way that Jesus defined himself today. And I'll just say it like this. Jesus is controversial. He's not soft-handed in a lot of what he says, and he makes some pretty amazing claims that give you no choice but to either love him or hate him. There's no real middle ground that he leaves for us, and one of the most controversial things that Jesus says or said is found in his claim to be God, his claim to be deity, the unique and only way to God. And on a surface level, I'll say this about Jesus. A lot of people like him. A lot of people hear his teaching, they read his biographies, namely the Gospels, and they walk away enamored with the way that he engaged with women, with children, with social outcasts, the sick, the downtrodden. People are convinced that Jesus was a nice guy. His teachings generally are perceived as trustworthy and good. The average person hears Jesus and they say, yeah, I can agree to that. It's a good teaching. You've got Muslim camps that encounter the Sermon on the Mount and they walk away just baffled at the high level of ethics that Jesus establishes through that sermon. So his teachings are perceived as a relative positive aspect of the society in which we live. And a particular gentleman by the name of W.E.H. Leckie said it like this. And mind you, he's an Irish scholar, a historian, and he's also a skeptic. So he's not necessarily a person that gives two hoots about who Jesus really is. And he says this of Jesus' character. The character of Jesus has not only been the highest pattern of virtue, but the longest incentive in its practice, and has exerted so deep an influence that it may be truly said that the simple record of 3 short years of active life has done more to regenerate and to soften mankind than all the disquisitions of philosophers and all the exhortations of moralists. So there you have it. Jesus has a captive audience. He's captivated both the religious and the irreligious. And his presence, his mere presence on earth, literally changed everything. We could spend hours trying to define the broadness of Jesus' reach, the way that he's impacted the treatment of women, children, slaves, the way that he's impacted, the way that we look at mathematics, science, education, and the arts. The bottom line is this, and I think John says it best when he basically says, there's not a book big enough to contain the life of Jesus. We couldn't write a book that long. He's impacted us on such a deep level, we just can't contain what he's done. And so, despite this level of general intrigue when it comes to Jesus, there are a lot of critics. And both you and I, at a time in our lives, stood as a critic of Jesus. And I'd like to tell you why I believe that. As explicit as Jesus was with regard to who he was, we're just as explicit. And I'll say it like this. Everyone, religious, irreligious, atheist, you name it, lives according to some explicit claim. It's a way of life that's marked by some uncompromising commitment to a particular way of defining who God is or who God is not, drawing lines between right and wrong, determining what defines human flourishing, determining on a day-to-day basis what you are going to do and what you're going to avoid. So whether consciously or subconsciously, I'd like to argue that we operate in the lane of an explicit claim. It's a lifestyle. It's a worldview that dictates how we make decisions, how we interact with people. And today we're going to look closely at Jesus' exclusive claim. So if you've got your Bible, go ahead and turn to John's gospel account. We'll be in chapter 14, and we're going to take a look right now at verses 1 through 7. And there, what you'll find Jesus saying is, "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may also be. And you know the way to where I am going." Thomas said to him, "Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way?" Jesus said to him, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him." All right. So there's a lot going on in these seven verses. And to give you some context, these seven verses are part of a larger discourse that is referred to as the Upper Room Discourse. It began in chapter 13, and it runs its way all the way through chapter 17, culminating with Jesus' high priestly prayer prior to his execution. Jesus, during this discourse, he's outlining a lot of things that he needs his disciples to understand. And on a basic level, Jesus is speaking to people who are absolutely in trouble. The mission that he started, the movement that he started, it's coming to a closing point. Because what's going to happen to Jesus is he's going to be executed. So in that Jesus is talking to people who are in trouble, I find that to be of great help to us because, quite frankly, we're in just as much trouble as they are. These men are his closest friends. They're his disciples. They're the guys that abandoned their jobs, their hometowns. They basically put everything on the line, the comforts that they were experiencing, to follow Jesus. And they're deeply anguished at the things that Jesus is saying. Because during their last meal together, Jesus simply explained that one of them was a backstabber at the helm of a plan to betray Jesus that would eventually cost Jesus his life. He told them about his imminent execution and that he would be leaving them and going to a place that they could not go. He had told Peter all about how when the going got tough or the rubber met the road, how Peter was going to absolutely turn his back on Jesus. Jesus was brutally honest with these guys, and it troubled them deeply. And in a sense, here's what Jesus is saying. I'm leaving, and you're not going to make it. You're not going to make it. And then Jesus goes on to say this. And mind you, he's speaking to 11 men. These are his disciples. At this point in time, Judas had left the room and had went to do what he signed up to do, namely to betray Jesus. So Jesus is going to introduce himself to us in what I believe as the response to human turmoil, to the turmoil that we find ourselves in. And here's what Jesus says. He says, "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me." So he's aiming at something here. He's aiming at the opposite of what we sense as we navigate life, as we're disappointed with how our relationships unfold or how our marriage unfolded or how our job's not going the way that we wanted it to or how we experience financial strain. He's aiming at shifting the trajectory of our focus here, at shifting the trajectory of his disciples' focus. He's telling his disciples, now is the time to trust me. Life is going to be hard, and it's time to trust me. It's time to move beyond ideas about me to absolute trust in me. And Jesus here is claiming to be the culminating revelation of God. He's claiming to be the very self-expression of God. This is a big deal. This is a really big deal. And the reason I would argue that is in verse 9, Jesus says this. He says, "Whoever has seen me has seen the Father." And then if you read further into verse 11, Jesus says, "I am in the Father and the Father is in me." Jesus is blatantly laying out his link with the Father and putting himself in a position to be the appropriate and unique object of our faith. And on the surface, maybe the disciples weren't really that amazed by this. Maybe it wasn't that big of a deal, being that they'd been tracking with Jesus. It's apparent that they believe him on some level. It's apparent that it was relatively easy for them to adopt an idea around monotheism. They're a monotheistic society in that they're part of a Jewish culture. Belief in one God and one God alone is in the Israelite playbook, namely the Old Testament. So, in a sense, these guys have done what a lot of people do. They've taken out their pen and they've checked the idea of belief in God as if it's a box, as if it's a box on some sort of survey that we would complete. They get it. They get the ideas about God. They've got a ton of head knowledge. They understand in their minds who God is and perhaps some of the things that he's capable of. But Jesus is saying, don't trust your ideas about me. Trust me, because life is going to be difficult and you're not going to make it unless you do trust me. So if we look a little bit deeper into Jewish culture, I think we run into an interesting concept. And it's something that we're familiar with. We have all used the term blessing, right? We bless our food, we bless our friends. At the end of a nice conversation, we might say, "Oh, God bless you." You give a guy a good Christian hug and you're like, "Yeah, bless you, bless you." It's something that we toss it around all the time. But there's a deeper concept of blessing when you look at Jewish culture. To them, the ultimate blessing was not found in a simple statement. To them, what they found as far as the meaning of the ultimate blessing was to be able to behold the face of the living God. And if you're familiar with the Old Testament, this is something that terrified them. I mean, this set people ablaze. There was a belief that if we see the face of God, we're going to die. God's holy. We're not. It's going to put us out. It's going to put us out of the camp. This is something that they were terrified of. And Jesus is standing there looking at these people in the eye and saying, you're looking into the face of God. And if you backtrack into the Old Testament, cruise through a book called Numbers, chapter 6, verses 24 through 26. What you're going to read there is, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. This is Hebrew parallelism at its best. These three verses say the same thing. And what they're saying is, we are dying for a face-to-face relationship with God. We're dying to see God for who he is, to know God for who he is. And what Jesus is saying is, I'm what you've longed for. I'm what the Old Testament prophets have talked about. I am the face-to-face relationship with God that the world needs. And he doesn't stop there. He continues and he says, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may also be. And you know the way to where I am going. So obviously the purpose of this passage is to solidify our belief that Jesus is a carpenter. Right? He's going to build something. He's going to build a house. I'm just kidding. He's laying out the architectural framework for this mansion he's going to build. Okay, this passage is not about carpentry. And it's not about a literal building as if the house of God were in disrepair. Jesus clarified in the 25th chapter of Matthew's gospel account that the kingdom prepared for his followers has been established since the foundation of the world. So it's been established and it's not going anywhere. Jesus is still in the vein of face-to-face relationship. He's talking about, at this time, what must happen to secure that face-to-face relationship, the intimacy with God that we all long for. And what he's saying is, the way's not ready yet. The way to God is not yet prepared. He's saying that the debt of all the wrong things that we've done has not been paid. He's saying the only way you're going to get to the place that I'm talking about, which is a face-to-face relationship with God, is if I clean up the mess that you've made. You're only going to get here if I become a curse for you and take the bruising of God on your behalf. He's saying I have to defeat death. I have to give my life and take it back again. I have to strip the power of death from the very jaws of death, so that you can live in the presence of God. Jesus is not talking about building a house. He's talking about making way for our absolute and never-ending relationship with God. He's saying, I'm about to remove every aspect of human turmoil that exists between you and God. And that's what Jesus means when he's saying, I'm going to prepare a place for you. That he's preparing it, not in the sense that it's defective, but that the way had not yet been prepared. His departure, the departure that he put on the table of the disciples, was for their advantage. To prepare a place, the place already exists. It's always existed, according to Matthew chapter 25. What didn't exist up to this point, and we read the rest of the story, so we know how it plays out. What didn't exist up to this point was the way there. And so Jesus goes on to say that he's the way, and he's the truth, and he's the life. And Thomas said to Jesus, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. So this guy Thomas, you'll run into him if you read the New Testament. He's a lot like us in the sense that he's really loyal. So some of us are loyal. He's relatively courageous. He's willing to get in the game, get dirty, make things happen. But this guy is full of misapprehensions and doubts. I don't know if you remember, but he's the same guy that was skeptical to the degree that he had to actually physically put his hand in the wounds of Jesus to validate that Jesus was who he said he was after he had risen from the dead. He hates ambiguity, and he's asking for some specifics, and perhaps his game plan is, I'm going to get the specifics and then coach somebody, let them know what's going on with regards to where Jesus is going and how we're going to get there. At the end of the day, he seems a little bit confused, and what Jesus says in response to Thomas' question is of cosmic proportions, in my opinion. It's an exclusive claim to be the only way to God. And this passage, although it could be used as a Christian apologetic, it's not really a Christian apologetic in my opinion. It's Jesus explicitly proclaiming his identity as God. And so the maxim of our day states that sincerity is far more important than belief, that you can believe anything as long as you're sincere about it. And what that gives room for is a belief that all belief systems are equal. And you and I, we live in a country where, by law, an equal respect of beliefs has been established. But what this maxim fails to identify is that all religions and belief systems are not the same. And a guy by the name of Ravi Zacharias says it like this. He says, all religions are not the same. All religions do not point to God. All religions do not say that all religions are the same. At the heart of every religion is an uncompromising commitment to a particular way of defining who God is or is not, of defining life's purpose accordingly. Anyone who claims that all religions are the same portrays not only an ignorance of all religions, but also a caricatured view of even the best known ones. Every religion at its core is exclusive. So citing Jesus' words in John 14:6 will surely classify us as narrow-minded, intolerant bigots, because Jesus is saying there's not room for any other belief system. There's not room for anyone else assuming the position of God. He's saying, I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life, that no one comes to the Father except through him. And what separates Jesus' exclusive claim from the exclusive claims of other religions, Buddhism, Islam, Universalism, we can even throw Hinduism in there. We can even talk about atheism as an exclusive belief system. What Jesus is offering us is not another idea about God. He's claiming to be the only way to God. He's saying, no, all paths do not lead to God. And he's openly rejecting any human invention as a means to even approach God or get close to God. This is a pretty big deal. This puts us in a real dilemma as people who follow Jesus. We really have no choice but to say the same thing that Jesus is saying, that he is the way, the truth, and the life. So I'd like to zero in on another aspect of the controversy that God creates in Jesus in making this remark. And we're going to transition and talk a little bit about Jesus' claim to be the absolute truth. And this is another challenge to the postmodern world in which we live, the individualist society in which we find ourselves, where truth is perceived as relative. And Jesus is not saying, I'm one of the possibilities among a bunch of possibilities. He's not saying, your truth is your truth and my truth is my truth. He's saying that all the ideas that you have about truth can be discarded because I am the absolute truth of God. He's saying that through me, you can know God and understand reality because he is the true revelation of God. In Jesus' day, it was a lot like ours, full of religious people. And these are the rule people. They're experts in rules and regulations. They got fancy checklists and things that you're supposed to do to become holy or better than the guy sitting next to you. Back then, they were known as Pharisees. Today, we just call them, frankly, annoying. Maybe you've met some of them. Maybe you've been one of them. Maybe you're currently one of them, so I don't want to offend you. I apologize for saying that. But there's more to the story than the checklist. And the Pharisees then, you see, they were zealous for the law. They were the Bible study guys. They were the come to my house and learn what it's like to be a follower of God. But one thing that they clearly misunderstood was the love of God. And they imposed tons of judgment without issuing out any level of mercy, punishment without love, criticism without understanding, and in the name of hating sin, they went so far as to just hate sinners. They classified people as sinners. They kept them at an arm's length, didn't want them in their homes, and they thought that somehow avoiding sinners was going to make them more holy. What that breeded in them was this idea of condemnation. So condemning people became a part of the daily routine. Their lives were far more centered on rules than relationships. I'd wager that some of us have been there. You know, the parents out there where we're trying to navigate child rearing and we got these rules and then we got these relationships. And what do? It's a real dilemma because there are certain things that we have to do, but we're also called to relationship with people. And I think what we're getting at here is there's something bigger in the person and work of Jesus than any of the rule systems out there, any of the religious systems out there. So here's what happened. Jesus comes proclaiming to be the Messiah. These people had waited for a Messiah. And this is where the confusion ensued for them as people. You see, they assumed that Jesus would be like them. They truly thought that. They thought he was going to wear distinguished robes, that he'd roll around the streets avoiding sinners like the plague and wanting people to stop and pause and offer reverence to him. They assumed that God was going to be just like them. And quite frankly, they were wrong. Because Jesus, what he did is he purposefully sought out sinners and he befriended them. He wasn't concerned with his reputation. He wasn't on mission to try to prop up his image or his self-image by putting other people down. That wasn't why Jesus was here. He was God. He was perfect. Yet, by way of his actions, he didn't go out condemning people. He went out welcoming people to himself. These were the worst of the worst if we were trying to quantify things. Jesus came to bear witness to the truth and dispel the myths about God that live in our minds. Lies that say on one end, we're too good for the grace of God. We've done everything. We don't need God's grace. We figured it out. And then on the other end, the lie that's centered on, I'm just not good enough. I've crossed the line of morality and there's no turning back. There's no hope for me. And sometimes we apply that thinking to ourselves, and sometimes we apply it to others. And at either end of that spectrum, what we're saying is we're better than God in some sense. We don't need the grace of God, or the grace of God can't help me. So what Jesus came to do is reveal the truth about God in reality so that we could come to grips with understanding our desperate need, and then turn understanding God's great love for us. Jesus goes on to claim to be the life. And I'd like to just pause here because the way, the truth, and the life, Jesus isn't laying this out as three bullet points. It's one statement. It all goes together. You can't divorce any one from the other. But in John 5:26, what we read is, for as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself. So anyone alive today can certainly attest to the mess that we're in, and I'd argue that anyone who cannot is just simply delusional. If you don't sense the mess that we're in, or the underground trembling, the moral dilemma that we find ourselves in, I would say that you're kind of out of touch with reality, because there are some serious things going on. And the world has been this way since Adam and Eve, the first man and woman, decided to rebel against God. They looked at the first rule that God gave them, literally the only rule that God gave them, and they decided to believe a lie about God and do the total opposite as to what God had prescribed them to do. And where we find ourselves today is a direct result of that. And we see evidence of this in headlines, in the lives of our neighbors, our friends, our loved ones, our family members. And Jesus said that he was the life because I believe that Jesus is God's response to death. The death that entered the world through Adam, that's plagued humanity ever since that day. And Jesus didn't just come to give bad people good ideas about behavior or change the trajectory of how we treat each other. Jesus came on a rescue mission to infuse life into spiritually dead people, who each of whom are headed towards an ultimate physical death. He came to face our deepest fear and overcome the tragedy of death. And quite frankly, Jesus is the only way that we're ever going to overcome the sinful state that we're in, the experiences of today, the challenges of today, or the sin and death that entered the world through Adam and Eve. So, I'd like to say this next. Jesus is a face-to-face relationship with God. If you know Jesus, you know God. And I think one of the most dangerous things that we can do is attempt to define God based on our own imaginations. I know we're good at this. And we come up with all sorts of fallible, subjective ideas about who God is, what he's capable of, what he will and will not do. And most of the time, we're real apt to project those things on him, and we haven't found any real biblical evidence of the ideas bubbling around in our minds. So it plays out kind of like this. If we had a lousy father, or family life was really bad, we assume that God somehow is going to be a lousy father, or we can't really wrap our minds around the idea of God taking care of us as a father. If we've experienced rejection, abuse, or tyranny at the hand of people in authority, we assume that somehow God is going to treat us the same way. And some of us live in constant fear that God cannot love us, and he's on some weird mission to destroy us as a result of the bad things that we've done. Or we count others out of the grasp of God's grace. We look at the way that they've lived life. We said, no, they're way over the moral line. There's no turning back for them. There's no way. God will never meet them where they are. And we adopt these ideas because we imagine God that way. We feel guilty for all our bad deeds, our abuse of others, our wrong thinking. And so we suppose that an infinitely just God must be infinitely mad at us. And in Jesus, we find something quite different. Because you see, the Pharisees, and some of us, we think in terms of Pharisees in our daily lives. Just the reality of who we are. We're rule-oriented. We think that somehow we're going to get there on our own. The Pharisees had an idea about God, and Jesus turned that on its head. And in Jesus, what we see is a picture of God markedly different than any idea that the human mind could potentially come up with. We see a God who genuinely loves us despite our flaws, despite our mishaps, our hang-ups, our outbursts. We meet a God who entered human history and became a person just like us. He put on human flesh. He experienced and overcame struggles just like ours. He was ridiculed, he was beaten, and eventually executed on our behalf. We see a God who appeared to be dead, and then 3 days later, overcoming the grip of death, putting death itself to rest. We see a God who empowers people through his Spirit to know him, to trust him, to have life now, and to anticipate an even better life then. We meet a God who is the exclusive way, yet inclusive of all people. Because there are no prerequisites in coming to Jesus. Because simply said, Jesus himself is the prerequisite. Jesus' work is absolutely finished. And he's extending a welcome to all people everywhere. And since... I'd like to leave you with this. Since you've been raised to new life with Christ, set your sights on the realities of heaven, where Christ sits in the place of honor at God's right hand. Think about the things of heaven, not the things of earth. For you died to this life, and your real life is hidden with Jesus in God. And when Jesus, who is your life, is revealed to the whole world, you will share in all his glory, because Jesus is a face-to-face relationship with God, because Jesus is the way to God, Jesus is the truth of God and the life of God. Quite frankly, Jesus plus nothing equals everything.